Right, hello everyone, it's good to see you all, and I've been really looking forward to speaking to you today as I've studied Song of Solomon, or Song of Songs as it's also known. Now we are on the penultimate sermon in our series on the heart, and the last sermon is going to take place on the last Sunday of the month. Trevor will be preaching on that sermon. That's going to be, I think, the trusting heart. Proverbs 3:5, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. That's going to be a really good way to end the year, to focus on our hearts trusting in God. But today we're going to think about the rejoicing heart, focusing on Song of Songs chapter 3 verse 11, which we've just read. Now this has a different focus to all of the other sermons and passages that we've looked at thus far in our heart series, because those passages have focused on our hearts. And sometimes it's been a bit difficult, hasn't it? Because we've been told that our hearts are sinful and deceitful and things like that. But this sermon focuses on God's heart, on Jesus's heart, and how it rejoices. So just to remind you of that verse, come out and look, you daughters of Zion, look on King Solomon wearing a crown, the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. So we're going to focus on this verse and see what it means for us. But before we do that, let's look at the context, as we have done for the last couple of sermons. What is the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs? Well, it's a collection of love poetry which celebrate love and sexual desire. But they're interwoven with allegories which present us with God's love for his people. So there's kind of like two levels in the Song of Songs. Level one, love poetry, celebrating sexual desire. Level two, what God thinks of us, how much he loves us, how his relationship with us, his people, is. What's the purpose of the Song of Songs? I looked up my old lecture notes from Dr. David Green, who is now the principal of London Theological Seminary, where I studied. And he gave a great summary of the purpose. Why was the book written? It's to stop love going out of our relationships with God and with one another. It's all about love. Love is central to the Bible, isn't it? To God. And love should be central in our relationships with God and with one another, especially in the marriage relationship. The clue is in the name. So it is known as the Song of Solomon, but it's also known as the Song of Songs. And that's like a sort of Hebrew way of saying the greatest song. And what it does is points us towards love as a great thing. It's a song of love, and it's saying love is a great thing, and the love that Christ has for us is the greatest thing of all. That's what the name of the book teaches us. So there's a lot of sexual desire expressed in the Song of Songs. The book says yes to sex, but in the right context. And I like this quote from the Bible Project. Though both lovers are immensely captivated by each other, the woman methodically reminds the readers to wait for this special passion at the right time. So the book is very clear. Sex is a wonderful and a good gift from God, but the context is marriage. Sex is to be within marriage. The genre of the Song of Songs is, it's wisdom literature, but it's poetry as well. And it uses all sorts of poetic devices and sentences, things like parallelism, assonance, alliteration, simile, metaphor, refrain. It's got lots of them. It's very imaginative and artistic. It's very beautiful. I went on the Bible Gateway website quite a few times last week and listened to it being read by Poirot. You know, the guy who played Poirot, David Suchet, he reads it, doesn't he? He's got a lovely voice. And it was very beautiful to hear the poem read. And he reads it as it's supposed to be written. You know, he sort of expresses the things that the Hebrew expresses and so on. It's a very beautiful poem. There's lots of debate about how the book is structured. Some Bible commentators and theologians think there's not a kind of linear sequence or storyline. Rather, it's a load of poems which are cyclical and kind of go in these symphonic cycles where ideas and images get repeated and developed. The best way to understand Revelation is like that, and a lot of people think songs functions like that. But most commentators agree, and you can interpret it like that, but most commentators agree that there is a basic narrative structure, and it's this. First of all, there's courtship, chapter 1, verse 1 through to chapter 3, verse 5. Then it moves on to the wedding, chapter 3, verse 6 through to chapter 5, verse 1. And then it's kind of like honeymoon and married life, chapter 5, verse 2 through to the end of the book. And we are kind of in the middle. We are verse 11 of chapter 3. We're at the wedding stage of the book where Solomon's like going to meet his bride. The king is coming and he's just about to be married. So let's consider what this passage means for us. As we said, it's all about a wedding. And I just want to read it again to remind you of the kind of wedding parade, the wedding procession, which this verse is at the end of. Who is this coming up from the wilderness like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it's Solomon's carriage. There's like excitement here. Escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel. All of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle. So he's flanked by sort of royal courtiers, as it were, warriors, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. King Solomon, oops, go back there. Sorry about that. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon. Its posts he made of silver, its base of gold. Its seat was upholstered with purple. I like this bit. Its interior inlaid with love. And then it finishes off with verse 11 that we're focusing on. So the thing to notice here, and there's a few things to notice. First of all, like the armed guard, the courtiers, the warriors, with their swords drawn, kind of saying to us that King Solomon is going to protect his bride. He's expressing that. The lavish carriage, he's given her, wants to give her lovely gifts. And celebrate her. But for our purposes this morning, we want to notice that the groom's heart is rejoicing. That's the big thing that we see. It's his wedding day, and he is rejoicing over his bride. So the different translations express this really well. So there's the NIV, but I like the way the Message puts it. My king lover, dressed and garlanded for his wedding, his heart full, bursting with joy. That gives a good sense of the occasion. The New American Standard Bible puts it like this, and on the day of his gladness of heart. So you get the idea, you get the excitement that is inside him. I'm getting married today, and this is my bride, and I love her so much, and I'm going to be with her forever. That's what the poetry of this passage wants us to understand, this rejoicing over the bride. And what this does is points us onto level two. Do you remember I said there's sort of like two levels? There's the first level, that's love poetry and a wedding and marriage and all that. And we can understand it and we should understand it as that. But it points us beyond that. And what this points us to is to Christ, our bridegroom, rejoicing over us, his church, his bride. That's what this passage is teaching us. And we know that we're justified in interpreting it this way because there are lots of passages in the Bible that use this way of describing Christ and his church. For example, Ephesians 5, 25, 31, and sorry, that should be, I think, 31 to 32. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loves the church and gave himself up for her. It's a very close linkage there. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. You see how closely Paul connects a marriage between a man and a woman, and then the oneness and unity between Christ and his church. Revelation chapter 19, verse 7, let us rejoice and be glad and give him glory, for the wedding of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. The Lamb is Christ. The church, every single Christian, every person who's put repentant faith in Christ, they're the bride. And then 2 Corinthians chapter 22, verse 2, I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. So Paul is sort of seeing himself as a matchmaker almost, and he's wanting those Corinthian Christians to come to Christ and to stay with Christ. And that's how he uses this marriage symbolism, marriage metaphor, to describe their relationship. So we're not on shaky ground here. We're on solid ground. We are justified in interpreting this passage as pointing to our relationship with Jesus. So the good news for you this morning, if you're a Christian, is that this verse describes how Christ feels about you. It describes what's going on in his heart. It's very similar to Isaiah 62, verse 5. As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. You know, one of the privileges of being a pastor is when you conduct weddings, because you're kind of standing here, and the bridegroom is sitting like where Paul is sitting, his best man and so on. And then the bride comes in down the aisle, and as pastor, you get to see the look on the groom's face. The eyes light up. My bride, this is my wedding day. And you almost see in his eyes his heart rejoicing. And that is what is going on in Jesus Christ's heart when he looks at you. That's astonishing, isn't it? His heart is bursting with love for you. You know, we all need love. Very much. We have basic needs like food and shelter and warmth and stuff, but we need love. We can't survive without love. Even tough, tattooed rockers like Green Day, even they need love. I love this lyric from Boulevard of Broken Dreams. I walk a lonely road, don't know where it goes, but it's only me and I walk alone. My shadow's the only one that walks beside me. Sometimes I wish someone out there will find me. Till then, I walk alone. It's a haunting song. And we know that. We know the truth of that song, don't we? It's hard to walk alone, isn't it? We need loving relationships to function as human beings. Love is something we really need. Victor Hugo, who wrote Les Miserables and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, he said this, the greatest happiness of life is the conviction that we are loved. And we are by Christ. We are. When he sees us, his heart skips a beat, as it were, because we're that precious to him. Some of us have trouble believing that, especially if we don't think much of ourselves. This is Jordan Peterson. I'm reading his book at the moment, 12 Rules for Life. I'm reading it with a guy called Justin, who comes to Messy Church, and we discuss it, and I caught up with him yesterday, and we had a good old natter about the book and about what we'd read. But in that book, Peterson describes those of us who find it hard to accept that Christ really does love us in the way that Song of Songs, chapter 3, verse 11, describes. He says this, they shoulder intolerable burdens of self-disgust, self-contempt, shame, and self-consciousness. They are excruciatingly aware of their own faults and inadequacies, and ashamed and doubtful of their own value. I feel like that sometimes. And maybe you do. And maybe in a sense this sermon is hard for you because you think, can Christ really love me? But you know, Christ loves us unconditionally. And so that's how we should love and accept ourselves too, and other people. You see, sometimes we put conditions on whether we love us ourselves, whether we're happy with who we are, whether we're going to accept ourselves. We say, I'm only worth something, I'll only love myself if I'm successful, or I've made something of my life, or I'm beautiful, or I'm muscular, or I'm a certain size, and we add conditions, and we say, well, I'll only accept myself if I'm like that. But Christ doesn't have those conditions for us. He doesn't say, I'll only love you if you've got a big bank balance, or you're well qualified, or you're beautiful, or you've got the looks of a film star. He doesn't say that. He loves us as we are. He loves us with our shame and with our inadequacies, with our faults. That's how he loves us. You know, if we have this tendency to put conditions on whether we accept ourselves, we probably will do the same to other people. I'll only accept you if you're at a certain level. We don't have to function like that, because Christ doesn't. You may feel very strongly a sense of this that Peterson articulates, but Christ loves you nonetheless. He doesn't say, I'll only love you if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. If you, as my teacher in my school used to say, pull your socks up, James. He doesn't say that. He loves us as we are. Learn to love yourself and accept yourself, because Christ loves you and accepts you. And this verse later on in the book, from chapter 7, this verse is for you this morning if you struggle to accept yourself as you are. Because as Christians, we can say, I belong to my beloved and his desires for me. I can say, I belong to Jesus Christ and his desire is for me. And that's what we should say to ourselves regularly, to remind ourselves that we're loved. But maybe you're thinking, but I keep on sinning. I know I'm loved, but I keep on being tempted and slipping into the same repeated cycle of sin. Does Christ love me when I'm doing that? Well, when we sin, Jesus is grieved with our sin, absolutely, because he sees where it leads and he sees the harm it does to us. But he doesn't stop loving you in your sin. He doesn't say, right, you're sinning now, I'm going to withdraw myself from you and my love for you. While we were still sinners, Christ loved us and continues to do so. And actually, his love for you means that if you are in like a repeated cycle of sin, he, by his loving power, will enable you to gradually become free from that sin which is dragging you down. So even when we go through dark periods of our lives as Christians, and we're doing things we know we shouldn't, his love is still constant, because his love doesn't depend on our moral performance. I want us to move on now and notice something else about this passage. It's a royal wedding. Now, we've had quite a few royal weddings, haven't we? We've had Harry and Meghan, and there was another recent royal wedding, and I can't remember the names, but you know who I mean. It's quite clear, really, when you read it. King Solomon wearing a crown, the crown with which his mother crowned him. He's a king. And all that we thought about this massive procession, you know, of his sort of army and whatnot, it's very grand. There's a lot of pomp and ceremony here. And when there's a royal wedding, especially if it's like a Harry and Meghan wedding. Meghan wasn't royal, she was an ordinary gal, and she married a royal. When she was united to him in marriage, she received royal privileges. And we're going to watch a video now, a short video, which explains and describes what these privileges are. It's from an outreach course called 321. And as you watch it, take it in, but apply it to yourself as well. That's brilliant, isn't it? That is what happens when we become Christians, when we're united to Christ in faith. You see, Christ not only rejoices over us, but he not only delights in us, but he gives us his riches. We become royal, as it were. We're invited into the royal family of God, the triune royal family. If you feel bad about yourself because of the bad things that you've done and the bad person that you are, don't forget this. Your badness has been taken by Jesus, and his goodness has been given to you. That's what happens when we become Christians. Do you feel shame, I wonder, about your life, about your past? Don't forget this. When Jesus died for you, he took on himself your shame, and he gave you his name, his royal name, so that you can now call God my Father. He lifts us up when we're united to him in faith. And that is the basis on which we can feel okay about ourselves and accept ourselves and have poise and self-confidence because of what we are now, because of what he's made us into. We don't have to feel good about ourselves because of our performance, but because he's made us into a new creation and wonderfully transformed us, just like that video described. What's the takeaway from this sermon then? What can we take home with us from today? Well, I want you to take away this: to enjoy and be amazed by Jesus Christ's love for you and for us, because it is an individual thing. He loves us, but he loves his church too, doesn't he? To look around and think to ourselves, he loves her, he loves him, he loves that person, and be amazed by that and to enjoy that and to be secure in it. Lean into it, especially when you feel alone or you feel worthless. Get your strength from that. Marvel that you don't have to earn his love. Allow it to give you that self-assurance that we need just to go through life. The Song of Songs concludes like this. This is the climax of the whole book. This is the final poem in a final chapter that rounds everything off. It's the most important part of the book. Love is strong as death. Its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot sweep it away. If one were to give all the wealth of one's house for love, it would be utterly scorned. And what this poem does is it tells us about love, what love really is according to God. And it defines it in three ways, all beginning with P. So first of all, this first bit, love is powerful. We can't stop death, can we? Sadly. The grave is powerful. Takes everyone. But you know what? Christ's love for us is powerful. It's unstoppable. It's unavoidable. And the verse describes love like a blazing fire, a mighty flame. We've seen the California fires, haven't we? And we've been stunned by the power of them. 80 dead, 500 missing, 150,000 acres destroyed, 13,500 homes completely burned to the ground. So powerful. But Christ's love for us is fiercely powerful, blazing mightily. That intensity is for you. Secondly, love is permanent. In a flood or a tsunami, buildings which look so permanent and so strong, they can be swept away, can't they? Just come tumbling down. Christ's love for us cannot be swept away. It lasts forever. Nothing, neither death nor life, angels or demons, the present or the future, any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation, will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. And finally, love is precious. Love is worth more than the entire wealth of an entire household. You can't buy love, can you? That's ridiculous. We know that. And we, as Christians, we have Christ's steadfast, faithful, committed, precious love with us forever.